Hello.
Hello.
This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
Hey, VREP community, it's Adam Scalina.
And Matt Scalina.
And if you're joining us today, you really should be spending time with your family, but we
shame
are...
Shame on you.
Yeah, shame on you. We all know, Matt, you're probably about three pieces into a 1,000-piece puzzle, and I'm considering eating the orange that I got in my stock.
These are very specific things related to the Christmas season.
But we're bringing a couple episodes here. We're taking a couple weeks off.
Yes.
I never thought we'd do this, but we're taking a couple weeks off and we're bringing back some of the bangers of the past.
Yes, absolutely. And this is one of our favorite. It is Brad Lamb. And I got to say, I appreciate Brad Lamb partly because he pulls absolutely no punches. He's one of the most successful developers in Canada. And when we actually called Brad for this interview, he put us on hold for 2 seconds while he negotiated a very, very large deal.
You know what? It was almost, if it wasn't real, it was real. But it almost seemed like an 80s power move. Like he called us and he was like, I said $2 billion. Yeah. Hold on, guys.
Like, yeah. I got to take this. And then he was like, $1 billion or I'm out. And then he was like, okay, let's
sold
do this.
For $1.5 billion.
yeah, exactly. It was crazy, though. It was crazy. Inside the dealings of Brad Lamb.
Yeah.
Also, our favorite thing about Brad Lamb was clearly his ads that came out in Ontario. That guy changed the game for real estate ads using just a lamb and a spacesuit.
This lamb sells condos. Yeah. But anyway, let's cut to the chase here. The man who needs no introduction.
Yeah. Here's an old episode, but one of our favorites. Enjoy. Okay. So we're here with Brad Lamb, broker and owner and real estate developer from Toronto. How are you doing, Brad?
I'm great, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time today, Brad.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
So Brad, can you maybe start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, you mean professionally, obviously. I went to university in Ontario, Queens, and while I was in university, I took mechanical engineering, and I realized in year three it wasn't what I wanted to be. I finished it. I got a job as an engineer, and I basically just plotted my exit from that industry into real estate, which the easiest and lowest hanging thing was to get a real estate license. I had been buying real estate in the 4 years that I worked as an engineer, and I just loved it. I mean, it got me excited every day. So I just, went from being a small to medium-sized investor, getting my real estate license, being a real estate agent, then a broker, then a substantial broker, and doing a lot of work for developers as their brokerage rep and advisor. And then I decided at some point in the early 2000s that I thought I knew more than they did, which, by the way, I didn't, but I thought I did. And I became a real estate developer and jumped right in with 2 feet and started developing. And so it's been an evolution since 2002 to now, where we're at today.
So, Brad, it sounds like I'm always interested in how people find real estate. You were an engineer. Like, how did you get interested in real estate in the first place?
Well, I mean, I've always been a salesperson, as a little kid, I everyone says they sold things. They had, they sold Kool-Aid, but I went farther than that. I sold everything. I had ice cream sales, ice cream sandwich sales. I had fairs. I had barbecues. I had sneak charming shows. I had movies. I sold everything that I buy and resell, everything. And I loved the idea of selling things and creating value from what I saw as nothing. Like, you could go to the local shopping store and buy, freeze pops that were a cent a piece. And then you could freeze them, which cost nothing because my mother's freezer for me was free. And I could sell them for 5 cents in 1968 or 69. and I could sell as many as I could do. And because the kids are so desperate for things to do, you know, there was two or three TV stations. There was no computers or internet. They were starved for things. So it was always exciting when I brought out new events and new products. And I loved that idea. So I first and foremost, I see myself as someone who sells things, sells ideas, sells products. I got into real estate. I saw it as an opportunity. I always liked it. I mean, I always sketched malls and buildings when I was a kid. And I loved, you know, there were certain games about land and real estate that I just loved playing. But when I was in my second year at Queens, we, a bunch of us had rented a house. And at the end of the year, the house went up for sale. And we were paying $900 a month rent on this in 1982. And the house was up for sale for $55,000. And I grabbed my calculator and I looked at that and I thought, wow, the net income on this is off the charts. So, you know, with 10% down, which you could buy a property for 10% down and rent it. So $5,000 or $6,000, you can literally make $4,000 or $5,000 a year in positive cash flow, pay off your mortgage, and of course hope for the best in terms of capital appreciation. So I realized that this was something. It was very lowbrow. Nothing compared to doing engineering. I just thought, wow, it's that easy. And this is the thing that people don't understand. It is that easy. It's that simple. You buy real estate, you rent it for more money than it costs you, and you put it away forever. So once I saw that, I got bitten by it. And I first thing I did was I formed a company with my two brothers who weren't really interested, but I kind of bullied them into it. And my dad gave my younger brother some money. I put in my savings, some work, and my older brother put in the same amount of money. We bought a townhouse in London, Ontario, and we rented it to my little brother, who was going to med school at the time, with three friends. So we rented it for $800 a month, and we bought the place for $32,000. So you see the math. It worked really well. And I just from that point on, I just kept buying more and more real estate. I was really quite addicted to it. I'd sell something and buy three. Sell those a year and a half later and buy six. You know, like I kept trying to expand and the thing about it was that what got me to get a real estate license was the fact that I really liked selling, and my engineering job was quite oriented towards sales. And I'd been trained professionally to be better at sales through that job. And then I asked my real estate agent at the time, how much money did you make for me last year in commission? And he said $70,000. And I had made 50 as an engineer. I thought, well, that. I'll make $70,000 and I'll sell myself stuff and I'll be better off than I was as an engineer. And I'll see all the opportunities, you know, and be able to be full-time in real estate. And I never considered being a real estate agent, so to speak. I thought I'd represent myself. But then I went to real estate school and people are having a hard time calculating mortgage payments. I thought, wow, this is going to be like stealing candy from a baby. So I stole the candy from the babies.
That's
a great story.
That's a great story. Brad, so we've got a ton of listeners that are you know, investors and also real estate agents that are probably looking at your career and wanting to follow in your footsteps. What's one piece of advice, maybe an overarching piece of advice that you'd give to aspiring real estate moguls?
Well, you know, I think the first thing is that you have to take it a step at a time. Like I don't think that in 1988, when I left my job, that I ever considered I'd be where I am today. I didn't think that large. I mean, I eventually did. Eventually, after selling real estate and being good at it and making some money, and I became a millionaire, I set these goals that by 60 I wanted to be a billionaire. I worked hard towards that. So having goals is important, but also if you don't reach your goals, not to worry. You know, you can still kick the can down the street a bit. But I think more than anything, what I did was I always took as much money as I could from my earnings, and I lived, I'm not going to say I lived simply because I didn't live simply, but I didn't live, like I lived at my parents' house till I was 30 or 31. And I when I left my parents' house, I was a millionaire. And in 1990, that was a lot of money. And I only could do that because I accumulated every dollar I could and I invested into real estate and I had a shitty car. I dressed well, but not extremely well. I wasn't crazy. I didn't have the best watch in the world. I did everything I could to take my money and put it into the system. And I realized that the faster I did that and the younger age I was, the more time it would have to earn me money. Right. The problem is if you start at 50, it's not impossible, but it's harder than if you start at 24. So I started right away and I put as much money as I could. When I was working for developers on a 200 unit building, I would buy four or five apartments and I would struggle because, you know, it would require me coming up with $200,000 in deposits and I have to get mortgages. And the developers who I work with say, why are you buying all these condos? I say, well, wait a minute, you're building these buildings and you don't see the value in what you're doing? I'm like, well, not like, what are you going to do, rent them? I'm like, yeah, I'm going to rent them. You're selling these for $160,000 and the rent is $1,200 and interest rates are 5 or 5.5. Do the math. It makes sense. You actually make a positive cash flow. And if you believe that the marketplace is going to increase, which every year you've been developing, you've raised your prices, makes sense. So I talked many of the people that I was working for and with into buying real estate. They didn't even believe in their own product. So I did it through condominium purchasing. I didn't do it through, in the early days, commercial real estate or single family homes or duplexes or triplexes. I started out that way and I hated being a slumlord. I wanted to rent to lawyers and doctors in their 20s and 30s that would pay me rent every month and not call me all the time. So I kind of focused on real estate that was for the upper middle class, but sort of, you know, that element back in those days that made $75,000-$80,000 and could afford a one bedroom. And so I would say so I'm rambling a little bit, but the one piece of advice I'd say is do everything you can to get your money in the system without taking, and this is the balance, without taking too big a risk and over investing and getting yourself in trouble. So it's a balance. It's hard to reach. You're always going to feel like you could have done more. Like I look back now on the mistakes I made on things I should have bought. And I'm not talking about millions. I'm talking about billions of dollars of money I could have made if I didn't pull back. But then, you know, what could have happened is there could have been a bigger, deeper recession. There could have been, something else that happened when it didn't. And I wouldn't be standing today. So it's all about balance and taking risk without taking too much risk.
So Brad, we have a lot of listeners that are just trying to get into the market. I think, especially in a place like Vancouver, where it's pretty tough to get in. It sounds like you bought a number of investment properties before you ever bought a principal residence. Is that kind of a route you'd take, or do you think it's smarter to buy a principal residence first?
Well, I think you got to do what you can do. So whenever you're starting out in your 20s, you can never afford what you want. Like, I remember a friend of mine was very wealthy. His dad was very wealthy. And he was living, he was renting in an amazing condo downtown. And I was living in my parents' basement, which was nice. It was a nice house. It had a pool and everything. And my parents had some money. But it was, you know, I wasn't taking chicks home and shagging them like this guy was. I was living at my parents' house, you know. And the guy had a BMW and I had a used Volkswagen Jetta. And I'd drive down and see this guy, I'd be like, holy f***, like he lives in this building at the back. There's this outdoor pool. And at 6 o'clock on a Saturday, it's filled with girls. You know, I'm like, what am I doing? But, you know, what I did was I said, okay, I'm going to live for a later day. So I stayed from 22 when I finished school to 30. I lived as long as I could till my father threw me out in his house, their house, and I saved a ton of money. And I probably bought and sold 30 properties in that 8 years. And not only did I make money, but I also became very seasoned and very knowledgeable about real estate because I practiced it all the time. I could analyze things and you know, faster. And I didn't second guess myself, which pretty well everyone does when they buy real estate. They can't believe it could be true. Why am I so lucky to find this amazing thing to buy? And they don't buy it because they get afraid. So, for first time buyers, the key is you want to get in the market. So what did I do? I bought a townhouse in London with my two brothers. That was my first foray into real estate. And I didn't buy. So in 1988 or 87, before the market crashed, I bought a condominium from Floor Plans for $101,000 at Jarvis and Gerard, which is the Harveys across the street was called Hooker Harveys, because all the hookers used to hang up front. And I it doesn't matter to me. I want to be in the city. And I know that eventually this will be worth more than I bought it for. So I bought that, and it took 2.5-3 years to build. So in 1990, I moved out of my parents' house, and I bought that property with I had a $75,000 mortgage, and I lived in that property with my girlfriend at the time. And it took me eight years, and it took me 8 years of sacrificing by living in my parents' house. You know. It was great. My mother did my laundry. I had my own space downstairs. She cooked for me, and I loved her cooking. So, you know, it wasn't such a sacrifice, but for a young man, you want to get out and do your own thing. So what first-time buyers have to do is anything they can to get in the market. So maybe what a Vancouver first-time buyer does is maybe they buy in a neighborhood in British Columbia that is not so far from where they are, you know, where their center is. And they drive once a month, a couple hours to collect the rent and make sure everything's okay. They'll make money in that neighborhood. They have to build their nest egg and their little fortune to get into the marketplace. It's not your birthright to graduate from university and have a degree and get an amazing job and buy an amazing house. It's nobody's birthright. You have to earn it. And I earned it. I struggled and worked very hard. None of my friends did it. None of my friends were willing to do what I was willing to do. So if you make excuses and you think that it's just your privileged right as a Canadian citizen to have an amazing condo or house in Vancouver, you're wrong. You don't have that right. You got to work for it.
Mm-hmm. So Brad, what about it? You know, we know you've had a lot of success throughout your career. What were some of the biggest mistakes you made along the way?
Well, my first mistake was I waited too long to leave the brokerage I worked at. I was the by far the number one guy generating business there. I had a pretty big name at the time in the early 90s, and I felt loyalty to my boss, and I just had a hard time, you know, doing that. But I should have done it earlier. And not that people shouldn't be loyal, but there's time in everyone's life where they need to do something for themselves. And so I should have done that. And the other thing I'd say is it's the opportunities I missed. You know, there's many of them that I could talk about that they weren't small misses. Like I'll tell you about one parking lot not far from my office that I bought with two other gentlemen for $3 million. And it's about a 30,000 square foot parking lot. It's in prime Toronto, and we flipped it 2 weeks later for $3.35 million. So we each benefited from a $100,000 boost, mm-hmm. and I thought that was great at the time. This is like 19. This is 2001 or two, and that parking lot today is worth over $100 million.
Wow.
That parking lot can build. You could build 500,000 square feet of density on that parking lot all day long, 12 or 13 or 14 times coverage, let's say, and at $200 or $250 a buildable foot, which is the number in the desirable part of Toronto, you're at $100 million. Now, I made that mistake 10 times in my life, where I could have bought something, and I just didn't do it. And now I did buy other things. It's not like I'm bereft and, you know, going to be on the street, but I could have done more, and I regret that I didn't. But then also, if I had done more, maybe it would have put me in a position of not being able to be here. And, you know, because tenants leave properties, you have a hard time making payments, you default on a mortgage, someone takes it, and it's a chain of events that can ruin people in real estate. So I don't really regret it, but I'd say that I've made some mistakes in the past that I should not have. Maybe I should have bought more of those properties.
So speaking of opportunities and potentially missed opportunities, in Toronto and Vancouver especially right now, there's a lot of talk about cooling markets and there's been all sorts of government intervention. Where do you see the opportunities right now?
Well, you'll notice that these kind of events happen. So in 1991, Bob Rae got elected. Do you know who Bob Rae is?
Yeah.
Okay. And he completely ruined the Ontario economy, and 4 years later he was out and Mike Harris was brought in. In British Columbia, you have a coalition between a Socialist Party and a Green Party. Green Party should never be in power, should never be in power. The Green Party's job is to force change through some power and some lobbying efforts, but having a Green Party in power is just stupid. And having an NDP or Socialist Party in power anywhere in the world is stupid. And so BC is going to suffer for the length of time that party's in power. And I guarantee you that party's gone in the next election. Guaranteed. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I think that Vancouver is going to struggle until this party is gone. The province has gone too far left. And the same thing with Alberta. I don't see big money and people taking a big risks in Alberta until Rachel Notley's gone. And she's actually a kind of a centrist when it comes to, you know, politics, even though she's an NDP. She's an Alberta NDP. And then we had the most left-wing premier in Ontario's history. She wasn't a liberal. She was an NDP. She was a radical. And she did terrible things to our economy. And she did terrible things to our real estate industry, like just horrendous, just, you know, not one thing, but 10 things. Mm-hmm. So what happened is that, you know, no party status, 7 seats. People eventually wake up and say, I get it. This is not good. So I think that the future for us in Ontario is brighter than I think. If people want real estate prices to start rising again in Vancouver and the market tightening, it will not happen with this party to the same extent that it would happen if there was a liberal or semi right wing party in power. Same thing in Alberta. In Toronto, I think the election's in a year, so I think you're going to see things change in Alberta in about a year. I mean, change in a big way. There's a huge opportunity for people from Vancouver to buy a condo in Vancouver, get someone to manage it for you, and in 2 or 3 years, you're going to make a nice profit, and you can bring the money back to BC and maybe get a down payment for a home. That's something for us.
Sorry, Brad, are you saying buying Calgary or Alberta as opposed?
I think the three best markets to buy in real estate. Right, sorry, the four best markets to buy in real estate are Calgary, Hamilton, Ottawa, and Montreal. Those cities are all poised for, at some point, explosion of value growth because they're too cheap. They're way too cheap. I think Vancouver and Toronto have run, and what's happening is what's necessary, retrenchment. Otherwise, we would have blown up. Both cities would have blown up. So there's going to be a retrenchment, which doesn't mean we had a retrenchment in 2008, 2009. It was an 8% loss of value, and the market started up again. I think you're going to see a similar kind of thing in both cities. It may last a little bit longer where you go a little bit sideways longer in Vancouver because you have a government there that is completely anti-development, anti-real estate, anti-wealth. You know, it's an insane government. And the thing is, you know, Vancouver, it's so funny because what happens in these cities like Toronto, Vancouver, is everyone points the finger at developers, greedy developers. You know, you have these massive NIMBYist networks. And the reality is it's all NIMBYs in government that cause their own problems. They just can't see the forest for the trees. You know, if Vancouver had added, and all those buildings he said couldn't be higher than 28 or 32 stories, if they added 10 stories, what would have happened? Honestly. Would the city have just exploded because there's too much height? No. If they had allowed a condo to go from 50 to 65, nothing would have happened. It would have been fine. It would have been okay. And but here's what would have happened. There would have been tens of thousands of more apartments available, which would have kept pricing in check. And so now you can't go back. These buildings are there forever. You're never going to knock down a 300-unit condominium to build a bigger one. That's how are you going to get 300 people to sign on the dotted line to sell their unit? It's never going to happen. You're doomed. The city. So Vancouver doomed itself for being a very expensive city, and Toronto's done the same because we have a socialist premier in the biggest run up of real estate, and when we needed support from government, we didn't get it, and then we have a complete. You know, almost like radical left-wing governments running Toronto. We have a mayor that's not, but all the downtown wards are primarily massively left-wing. And you saw that in the election. Almost every ward in the city went orange. And these people do not see reality. They just don't understand that I don't know if it's they didn't go to school and get educated about economics, but it's... I know economics isn't a science, but it's pretty obvious that if you increase the supply of a product, the price will level off or fall. Mm-hmm. That's pretty obvious. And so if we've been constricting supply, if everything we've been doing in Toronto has been to constrict supply, how can you expect prices to do anything but rise? So we've ruined this economy for first-time buyers. Toronto is never going to be a place for first-time buyers, unless first-time buyers get help. It's like Vancouver, where it's going to be very hard for someone in Vancouver to ever buy a first home in Vancouver. They're going to have to do what I did as a stepping stone over 10 or 15 years to get there and be patient about how they have to get there. And it's going to be troublesome and a lot of work and so on. But in the end, they're going to get a home in the city they want to live in. But it's all government meddling that caused this. You just have to look at what councillors and mayors have done in Vancouver in the last 30 years to prevent density.
Right, right. And we've had a lot of people on that have said the same thing. There's a consensus, at least with the people we talk to.
Right.
Well, it's obvious. I mean, there's no denying. I can tell you that my cost, if I do a building that's 300,000 square feet, my costs are lower per square foot than if I do a building that's 150,000 or 180,000 square feet. I can reduce my prices by 7 or 8%. You know, and that's a huge amount. When you're at $1,000 a foot, that's $140 or $70 a square foot. That could be $50,000 in a purchase price in Toronto for a first-time buyer. It's a big chunk of money.
Absolutely. So, Brad, I'm just really interested here. You mentioned that the four areas, Calgary, Hamilton, Ottawa, and Montreal. If you had a couple, well, call it $1 million to invest right now, which of those markets would you probably go into?
And what type of property?
Well, most people can't buy commercial property because it's troublesome. It's troublesome to manage a plaza or a 10-plex from a distance. I think that if someone went to Calgary right now, they could buy a condominium in a fantastic building probably for $550 a foot. Calgary was more expensive than Toronto in 2007. So it tells you where it could go. Ottawa... So I have a ton of condos in Calgary. I have a ton of condos in Ottawa, and I had at one point a ton of condos in Montreal. And I made a mistake in Montreal because I was so sick of the tenant situation there. It's so pro-tenant that I raise rent from $1,000 or $1,100, $5, and the tenant would be like, I'm leaving. $5. You're leaving over $5. Yes, I'm leaving. So I had a bunch of condos that I bought. I developed a building there with partners, and I spent a lot of time on trail because of that. And I saw the city changing. So I was there on weekends. I'd walk in the sales office and buy a couple of units at each building I went into. And I had them all rented, and I had a friend of mine managing them. But I could never get any more rent. And it just made me angry. At one point, I was like, I'm selling everything in Montreal. I'm never going back again as an investor. I've had it. And then I watched over the last year Montreal just catch fire, and Montreal is, you know, Montreal, they have the right premier, they have a good mayor. Even the previous mayor that I think got into some trouble, he was very good for the city in the way of social works. Like, it's the most beautiful city on the street. You know, they're just constantly upgrading that city, and it's got a lot of really great civic pride. And I think it's a tiny city too, so it doesn't have a lot of room to grow. And they are tough about density. So I think that Montreal is great too. I mean, probably the three, Ottawa might be the weakest because Ottawa is a government town and mm-hmm. you have a problem. And this is a problem with Calgary too, in that it's an oil town, and so you have these swings. But I like Calgary because it's been hammered so badly that I think there's going to be a huge upswing. I like Ottawa because you have a government stability, so you don't get wild increases, just steady increases in price. And the city's going to grow because this Liberal government's going to be there for a very long time. Justin Trudeau is young, and people like him. And I think the Liberals will be a dynasty for a while, and Liberals are all about growing government. So I think that's a tremendous place to be. And I like Hamilton, too, because Hamilton is a city, and it's the cheapest city. Well, it's sort of in the same part of these cities, but you know, it's kind of new to Hamilton that they're people are seeing the opportunity, and I think that the growth of Toronto is enveloping so many other areas. Hamilton is distinct and a standalone city, but will be affected by the sprawl of Toronto. Just in terms of people saying, I'm not buying a house for $1.5 million in Toronto, and I can buy a house for $500,000 in Hamilton, and it's the same house, and I can live in Hamilton, and I can work in Hamilton, you know, and I can visit Toronto whenever I want. So it's hard to pick, to be honest with you. I think that, but in all cases, I would buy condominiums, because in all of those cities, you can make money as a landlord. I mean, you can buy, you can put 30% down. You can, and I buy them from floor plans. So don't buy something that's existing. Someone's already made the money on that. Buy something from floor plans, wait 3 or 4 or 5 years. You know, so when you get possession of it, you bought it in, you know, 2018 prices, you're closing in 2023. So you now own a property with 2023 prices, and your rent is 2023, which means you probably got a 20% bump in rent. So all your modeling is going to look very conservative. And these cities, you can buy property, rent it, and make money, which you can't do in Toronto, you can't do in Vancouver.
Right, right.
Excellent advice.
So is there one book that you've read that everyone interested in real estate should get a hold of? Or are you kind
no,
of...
it's not, there's not one book, but I'll tell you, I wrote a book, Let. It's called The Condominium Millionaire. And we've run it out through every city we've worked in to show people that in each city they can do this. We're about to update it again with new numbers because we haven't done it for 2 years. If people want to learn the basics, because you don't want to overthink this. It's not complicated. This book is 25 pages long. Read it. It'll show you exactly what you have to do and how you have to do it. And it's not going to take you more than 40 minutes to read. It's all you need to know about the condominium business in terms of being an investor. And it will also give you, if you read it and understand the fundamentals, you can apply them to buying a plaza, an apartment building. I just say this one thing about why condominiums, in my mind, are better than those other genres of investment properties. And here's why. When you buy a plaza, you're going to sell it on the cap rate. You're going to sell it on the income. That's the only way it's going to sell. If cap rates are 5%, no one's going to give you more than a multiple of 5% on your net income. Mm-hmm. That's the way it is. Same thing with apartment building, same thing with an office building, same with any retail space. But what's great about a condo, if you buy a condo, condominium can sell for a cap rate. So an investor could say, I need to get a net income on this, and I want to have a positive cash flow. But 99% of the time, you sell a condo as a single-family home. So you buy it from a developer on a cap rate program where you want to see close to positive cash flow year one, or positive cash flow year one. It's hard, but you might be able to do it. But if you can't do it, it could be positive cash flow year one from the standpoint of setting off how much you pay off in your mortgage, right? So if you lose a grand or two a year, but you're paying off $8,000 in your mortgage, it's not cash flow. It doesn't qualify as cash flow, but you're still up $6,000 a year in terms of getting richer,
right?
Regardless of it going up in value. But when you go to sell it, you sell it to an end user who doesn't care about cash flow or cash flow or cap rate or price per square foot. They care about, can I afford it or can I not? So you can buy it on the cheap based on the fundamentals of rental real estate, and you can sell it as a single family home at the highest valuation possible. And it's the only real estate you can do that with. And that's why I like it, because you pick your time to sell, and you can make, you know, people bought condos from us at the building we're completing right now. They bought condos at 530 to 540 a square foot. They're going to sell and they're going to close in another few months. And once they close, they can sell those for $1,125 or $1,150 a foot. So they put, you know, on a $250,000 small condo, they're going to put like maybe 25% down. So, you know, what, $65,000 down. And if they sell it, they're going to pull out $320,000. You could never do that ever with a plaza or an apartment building. It's a way to you know, you got to buy a lot of them to get rich, but it's a very good way for small investors to get ahead. And I don't suggest that they sell them at that point. I suggest they refinance them and go buy another two,
mm-hmm.
right? And then take the 25 years to pay off your mortgage. Have the tenant pay off your mortgage over 25 years. The worst case scenario is you own a condo outright in 25 years. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
No kidding. So, Brad, we got just one last question before we let you go, and we really appreciate your time. But we're big fans of This Lamb Sells Condos, the ad that you did there. I think it was around 2007, if I'm correct on that. How did that come about?
I did this ad in 2000 and. I can't remember. It's a very long time ago, maybe even in the 90s. And no one will remember this, but Burt Reynolds did this. Do you know who Burt Reynolds is?
Yeah.
Okay. Lots of people don't. So Burt Reynolds was a big movie star in the 70s, and he did this Cosmopolitan spread where he was lying on like a fur rug, and he was naked, and he was kind of lying horizontally with his head on his arm, you know, like sort of. And I think his knee was up too.
Yeah.
and he had the bearskin rug covering his, you know, stuff. And I remember seeing that, thinking that's kind of funny, you know, because it caused a huge uproar at the time. And so my name is Brad Lamb, and at the time Brad Pitt was, you know, very sexy, you know, popular actor, and everybody knew him. And I thought, okay, I'm gonna lie in this kind of horizontal thing. Well, I'll lie in my logo. So my logo is like a table, and the caption will be, okay, he's no Brad Pitt, but he sells a ton of condos. And that was the first thing I did, and it caused an absolute uproar. You know, people like, what the f-? Who does real estate ads like that? And ad agencies would call me and say, they should arrest you. That ad's so bad. I said, yeah, but you called me.
Yeah.
Like, how many people do you call and say, I like your ad, right? So it got me thinking about crazy ads. And then, you know, obviously my name being Lamb, I thought, well, how weird would it look for me to be like a minotaur and put my, you know, fat round head on a lamb and have a silly little smile on it and just start having funny little captions about it. So the first one I was, you know, was that this slam sells condos. And then I had a bunch of them. I, you know, I had like 10 different ads over a while that, that I did with that. And actually this year I'm back at that ad. I have that ad, downtown. It's even sillier. This year I'm wearing scuba gear with a scuba, with a, like a, like a glass bowl over my head. And I'm attached directly to a submarine by a hose, and there's a great white shark coming after me, and I have a spear gun. And it says, what does it say? It says, we go to great depths to sell you your home or sell you a property or something like that.
My favorite is the miles above the competition ad where you're a lamb in space.
Yeah, and no, I did that too. Yeah.
So Brad, how can people find out more about your developments and what you do?
Also find out more about the book. Like, is that an ebook or do you buy that on Amazon?
No, it's free. I don't make people pay for it. We are going to start printing a bunch for Ottawa and Toronto again. And if people want it, they just need to email info@torontocondos.com and we'll pop one in the mail to them. And with respect to our projects, we are very close to relaunching our now tired and old website, BradJLamRealty.com, I think it is. And then they can go to lambdev.com and bradjlamrealtyinc.com, and they can get information on our new project. So they can just send an email to info@torontocondos.com and my office will get back to them about what's coming up and what's new. We also have a newsletter that we produce quarterly. That's available through email, or we pop in the mail to someone if they want a hard copy. So anything they want of that nature, they just have to send an email to that address and we'll send it off to them.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much, Brad. That was a fascinating discussion. I think everyone will learn a lot from it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Two Thousand Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.